WIOX is supported by the following community underwriters. Watershed, Roxbury's Coffee Shop and Cafe on Main Street in historic Roxbury. Open every day from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. for coffee, pastries, fresh, casual food. And on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday evenings from 5 to 8 p.m., dinner by 808 Catering and full bar service. Watershed, Main Street in Roxbury. WatershedRoxbury.com and on Instagram at WatershedRoxbury. Caldwell Banker Timberland Properties, with six offices located throughout the Catskills, serving buyers and sellers of land and homes for over 40 years. Timberland Properties agents live, work, and play locally, with offices in Margaretville, Stamford, Roscoe, Delhi, Sydney, and Boyceville. TimberlandProperties.net, 845-586-3321. Mountain Flame in Arkville, featuring a range of products for home heating solutions. A variety of fireplaces, wood stoves, and gas and pellet stoves are available and on display. For sales and service, Mountain Flame in Arkville, warming home since 1980. Details at mountainflame.com. Hannah Mountain Resort and Country Club, with 29 guest rooms, restaurant, and bar. Specializing in wedding packages, including rehearsal dinner, ceremony, reception, farewell brunch, and accommodations for guests. And golf memberships are available for Hannah's 18-hole championship golf course. Information at HannahCountryResort.com or 845-586-4849.
Hi, I'm Kent Garrett, inviting you on board the 801 weekday mornings on WIOX Roxbury, community radio in the Catskills. We have local, state, national, and world news at 91.3 FM and on MTC Channel 20. And for the rest of the world at WIOXradio.org, or just tell your smart device to play WIOX.
All right, good evening. You're listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, and at 107.5 FM on the campus of SUNY Delhi, on smart devices through the Radio FM app, and everywhere at WIOXradio.org, where it's easy to donate. This is From the Forest, and every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., we talk about a different forest-related topic. And usually every third Wednesday of the month, we have a familiar voice on, but we switch things up a little bit. Second Wednesday this month, and we got a friend, Gary Mead, on the other microphone.
Yo, yo, here I am.
Yeah, it's your new MC, huh? Anyway. Well, Gary, for those who don't know who you are, why don't you introduce yourself?
Well, my name's Gary Mead. I was raised on a farm in New Kingston. I have a woodworking company in Margaville. I did production work for the better part of 42 years, and had employees and, you know, a commercial business, and I closed that down October in 2019, and I just work solo now. But I'm an artist not by choice. I'm an artist because I was chosen somehow. I don't understand it. I'm going to read a poem later to kind of, you know, help you figure out, understand, not figure out anything, but understand, you know, where I'm coming from. And what I do is I've been writing quite aggressively poetry and for about since 1978, 79. And I started putting them into compositions in about 1998. And you know, I have I do woodworking. I love trees and wood, and I pay attention. And I just want to. This show tonight. John called me yesterday, and he said, "Let's talk about small landowners and, you know, whatever." So I own property in New Kingston. I was we may as well come right out of the gate and talk about this, but I was born in 1954, September 27th, on a little farm in Westkill with 40 acres. My dad and mom and my dad, he had only, I think, 17 cows, when I'm able to realize, you know, about 5 years old is when I started remembering stuff, really. And, you know, my dad had, that was back when, in Westkill, when my dad had those 17 cows, with the D. LaValle vacuum system just came out online. And my dad, you know, like all farmers, they, you know, tried to make milking by hand a little bit easier, but he had three cows that would not let you anywhere near them with the vacuum system because their entire life they've been milked by hand. So while Dad, you know, milked 14, I milked three by hand, and I'm 5 years old, and I felt a very, I just wanted to be by my dad all the time. And my other brothers and sisters, you know, they kind of hung out in the house. And, you know, at 5 years old, I didn't have too many brothers and sisters at that point. But, you know, there ended up being seven of us and nine living in the household. So going to when I was 10 years old, we moved to New Kingston. And we moved from a 40-acre farm to, well, on the deed, the deed said we moved there in the spring of 1964, and the deed said 200 acres plus or minus.
that accurate?
Yep. Years after, because there was a farmer across the road. Well, it used to be Day Road back in the day, and now they've named it Thompson Hollow for whatever reason. But anyway, there was a farmer on the other side, which was the Jensen farm. That's been subdivided too at this point, but back in those days, before Jensen owned it, I can't even remember who owned it, but they had a parcel from our farm on their side of the road, and we had a parcel of their farm on, so they got together over probably hard cider one night and said, "Why don't we trade parcels?" So that's what happened. Nothing used to be as technical back then. But what ended up happening is, you know, when we come to find out, when we had the property surveyed, we had 254 acres. And that's 200 acres plus or minus.
Okay, so you're on the plus side then. Yeah, that's good.
Very much on the plus side.
As long as you're only paying taxes on the 200 minus side.
The guy that crossed the street that traded with us, it was a 10-acre parcel for a 40-acre parcel. And they swapped even. So I'm just trying to bring you into the mentality of the people that were living back in those days is, you know, 10 square feet, you know, I'll get one more cow. You know?
Right.
It didn't mean like, you know, you're trespassing, you need to keep off my property and blah, blah, and whatever. I mean, we've gotten into a lot of different rules and regulations anymore. And, you know, as a native, well, I call myself a native to New Kingston. I haven't lived up there for years, but when my dad subdivided, I think it was 1987, he had to sell the farm, and he sold all the equipment, he sold all the cows, he became, you know, like most farmers, they become in debt, and he didn't give up, he just figured that, you know, he needed to, so back in those days before the watershed kicked in, he could, I mean, we subdivided, and in the 80s, we were getting, I mean, not we, my dad was getting, you know, $6,500 to $8,500 an acre for five-acre parcels. So he sold all the equipment, he sold all the cows, and, you know, he started subdividing the property, and even after selling the cows and the equipment, he still had two mortgages against the farm, against the property, the 250 acres. So, you know, Redmond Real Estate, who used to be in Arkville, they came up and they kind of this and that. We had the place surveyed, and he started breaking up into five-acre parcels here, you know, up especially along what they call Mead Road now. It's a private road. I walk 3/4 mile every morning after getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and milking about 60 to 70 head. And we walk 3/4 mile down a road to meet the bus. But once it got turned into a town road, you know, the kids that lived there after that, the bus came up the road. But, you know, and in the wintertime, we had, back when last winter was a beautiful winter because it was an old-fashioned winter. It wasn't easy and it wasn't hard, but we had snow all winter, and it was the most normal winter we've had in a while, which, you know, I was grateful for that. And one reason being that, you know, climate change has been so drastic in the past, you know, 15, 20 years that, you know, it's a little bit scary at times, but see something normal come through was awesome. And not only that is, you know, nothing against people moving in the area, but, you know, there's too many that don't understand our area well enough to be proprietors of what we have here, and they don't get it. So what the hard winter did, and I can remember all last fall, I mean, this might be not funny to some of you New Yorkers, but, you know, we were hoping for a hard winter to drive some of you more further south. But I don't personally blame anybody for being ignorant about how to take care of our property up here, because you haven't been taught how to. You come from a place that is a totally different world from us. I mean, it's pristine, it's beautiful, but I mean, this is hard knocks survival here. I mean, if winters are hard. Of course they're hard. They're meant to be hard. That's why I spend all summer preparing for winter. You know, I grow my own food. I harvest, you know, stuff off the land. And because I'm educated in that, people that move into the area in the summer, oh, you know, they lay out in their lounger, and oh, this is beautiful. But then, you know, when it's 20 below zero and the wind's blowing, there's 3 feet of snow outside, they're not quite as, happier, and or they don't feel quite so intelligent about what they're doing. So if you're going to move here and be a permanent resident, you need to get educated on how to take care of yourself through the winter months, which are the lean months, and a lot of us, you know, in New Kingston, I was in 64, 65, we had a huge Victorian house, balloon built, no insulation. My room was back in the far corner, and, you know, it was 20 below zero and the wind was blowing. My bedroom was 40 degrees. It was above freezing. I was grateful for that.
Yeah.
And I had a border collie, a black and white border collie, that being raised on a farm, my parents never let animals in the house. It was a weird thing that I learned, you know, at a very young age. But, you know, my dad come home. He used to do artificial insemination, which, you know, layman's terms, it's breeding cows. He went to Cornell and he learned how to breed cows. And, you know, he'd travel all over the mountains here. He knew these roads like the back of his hand. It was the most amazing thing I ever saw. But anyway, my brother Gene and I would run the farm, and if he got a call to go, you know, artificially inseminate a cow, he would take off. But he come home this one time when I was 5 years old. He brought this border collie home. It was 5 pounds. And this is when I lived in Westkill. And, you know, I fell in love with that dog as soon as I saw it. And I went out, and it was in the fall of the year. And I went out into the, I didn't sleep in the house for about a week. Every night I went out, and because they wouldn't let an animal in the house, I went out in the barn and I slept with my dog. And so my parents let that one dog come into the house. And when we moved to New Kingston, he slept at my foot of the bed in the summer and under the covers with me in the winter, because he was, you know, my warmth. And after doing scouting for many, many years, I think I was 19 or 20 some years doing scouting with my boys, it reminded me when I got up in the on a Klondike Derby and it was 20 below zero out in a canvas tent, getting dressed is the hardest part when you're getting out of bed. You get up, and by the time you get your long johns and your clothes on, and, you know, our Christmases weren't, you know, big presents and, you know, blah, blah. We got fruit, and we got socks, we got long underwear, and we got stuff to survive through the winter. And we were grateful for that. I mean, and nuts. I can always remember these big bag of mixed nuts we got. It humbles you. And, you know, a lot of you folks out there, I mean, we've become very spoiled. And I don't disagree with it. I just say you really need to humble yourselves and say, you know, maybe I don't need that, you know, at this point. We're in a survival mode right now. We have more problems right now going on in the world than, you know, when I was growing up, life was tough. It was physically tough. The mental part, right now, it's mentally tough. And I'm telling you folks, right now, that's a lot tougher than physically tough, because I've never been so confused about any one thing in my entire life. And I'm 67 this year. And I really want this stuff to kind of subside and go away. But, you know, we've really, Mother Nature and Father Time, we have hurt them. And we need to figure that out. I mean, we're not here for us. We are here. There's a whole nother thing so much bigger than us that people aren't realizing. And you just got to grab life and love it with all your heart and soul. And you know, who cares if things are, you know, get a little bit tough along the way? Stop arguing and fighting with one another. It never accomplished anything. And when you're mad and confused, you make terrible decisions. So, you know, if there's any one thing you get from this radio show tonight, is learn to calm down. I mean, it's Christmas season. Everybody's want, and give me this and blah, blah, that. And, you know, whatever you get for Christmas, be grateful. We have it so much better. You know, because I was raised in 40 degrees in my bedroom in the morning. How many people on the planet can say they woke up in the morning, it was 40 degrees in their bedroom, and I went away about my day and I was happier than a pig in shit because it was my day. And, you know, I was allowed to have that day. And, you know, it isn't about material things and all that. So, but I'm going to get off that and get on to... So I left the farm when I was 17. I went into the hospital, had my tonsils out, and I didn't have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I didn't have to milk cows twice a day. My whole childhood was milking my day off from the time I was 5 until I was 17 was 6 hours. We worked 3 hours in the morning milking and 3 hours at night and milking and cleaning up. And, you know, all the events we had with my family, my grandparents and my cousins, and, you know, they would meet over in Jewett. My grandfather, Harold Mead, and, you know, my dad was Harold, and he had a garage in Jewett. We used to go over there for Easter and Christmas and all the holidays, and my family was the last to get there and the first to have to leave. And but I never went through life thinking I was damned or bothered by this. It was a way of life. And, you know, when we get into harder times, I mean, you folks that have silver platters, you're in for a tough time in the years ahead, because, you know, we're going to have to go back to survival mode and you know, forget about all these luxuries and stuff. And we are very fortunate, but we need to hold on to that. We really do. And but then I found art, and it's always been with me. And I'm not an artist by choice. I'm an artist by... It's a spiritual thing. And I got to tell you the God's honest truth. I don't understand why I was chosen for this. And I tried to make it not happen and leave me alone. And, you know, the first 8 years I started my company, Fruitful Furnishing, 1978. And the first 8 years I did custom woodworking and refinishing and I was starving to death. I started my family, and I'm trying to raise a family. And, you know, my biggest problem is I can't estimate how many hours it's going to take me to do something. So, and I only started making stuff for myself because I couldn't afford to buy it. And that's what started my company, is people would come to my house, and they go, "Oh, my God, you made that? And, oh, can you make me one?" And so... But that's how this whole thing got kicked off. And I started my company from denying an unemployment claim. I went to Oneonta. I mean, you folks that are getting unemployment now and for the past probably 25, 30 years, you call in every Sunday, blah, blah, I didn't get a job, and they send you a check. Well, back in the day... In 1978, I went up to Oneonta to sign up for unemployment, and I loved the days that if you didn't earn it, you didn't get it. But these people, you had to go through three different lines, and I had to travel an hour to go do this. So I'm signing up for unemployment, and I'm in the second line, waiting behind maybe 10 or 12 people. This piece of paperwork that I got from the people in front of me, or the receptionist in front of me, and this was only the second line. I had a third line to go in, and because I'm so high energy that I stand in the back of the line and I go, "Well, this sucks." So I walk to the front of the line. People give me dirty looks. I laid my piece of paper on the table at the receptionist, and I said, "My name's Gary Mead. I'm going to go start my own business. And if it don't work out, I'll be back." And I never filed that claim because, and, you know, the system works. It's been abused so bad that it can't work anymore. And sadly to say, it was being abused by citizens, but it's being abused now, and I can't emphasize this more than ever, is it's being abused by our politicians more than anybody on the planet. These guys have been let to get away with so much stuff that it's crazy. And why do we allow it? I don't get it. But anyway, so I started having, you know, building stuff, and I started Fruitful Furnishings. I went and I hired a lawyer, a business attorney, and Joe Shapiro. And, you know, he's been gone for probably 30, 35 years, but, you know, he was my first business attorney, and what a super guy I got hooked up with, because he helped me understand business, and because I had no idea. I was raised on a farm, feeding cows and milking cows and harvesting corn and picking stone, and you know, most of our days were 14, 16 hours, and my whole summer was harvesting hay. We filled two silos in the summer and put up about 18,000 hay bales. And, you know, that got us through the winter. And that was my summer. But we had cousins and, you know, and people that lived on the farm with us. And I wouldn't trade my childhood for anything in the world. You know, as life went on, it was like, it was the most beautiful and inspiring part of my life. But so anyway, I'm into this. I didn't know I was an artist in 78. I just needed to make money to support my family. And I didn't have a family in 78. You know, I started having kids a couple of years later, and you know, I have three wonderful sons. And but I started this company, Fruitful Furnishings, and you know, I just started making furniture, doing custom work. But you know, I'd give somebody, and you know, if you come to me with a picture of something you wanted, I could make that picture. And I did some pretty intricate stuff for not knowing nothing, and you know, inlays and overlays, and I had in high school, I had this notebook that said, "Winning is 90% attitude and 2% skill." And I lived with that for the rest of my entire life, and it does make sense, and it works for me. And if you have a good attitude about anything, and you know, I used to worry about a lot of stuff, and I don't worry, and anger and worry never really got me anywhere, so I just don't do it anymore. I mean, I challenge you to try to make me angry. It's not possible. It's just, you're not going to do it. But anyway, so I'm into this art thing, and I'm giving somebody a 40-hour estimate for this piece of furniture I'm building. And I didn't, this is back when I first started my company, and I did this for 8 years, and then I got into the dimension business with a local. I know most of you people know Titan Drilling. Lynn Johnson said to me one day, it's awful nice to have your own business and be a sole proprietor, but he said, you know, if you don't have employees, when you're gone, the business is gone. So when I was taking my family on vacations and stuff, the business was closed down. There was no money being earned. So a light bulb went off in my head, and you know, these people, I give 40-hour estimates. I'd take 100-plus hours to make whatever they needed. But what I admired the most about myself and the way I was raised, that I didn't hurry up and finish this effing thing because I needed to make money. Money had no bearing on it. I needed money to survive, but I didn't let it overtake me to the point where I was going to cut corners, and I was going to, you know, I take a 60-hour hit on some of the stuff that I was doing because, you know, I'm a man of my word. And, you know, if I tell you something, it's going to happen. But, you know, I'm not really fast to tell people that I'll do stuff. And I don't do a lot of commission work now. That's very selective. And I'm in my own little world right now. But, you know, building up to, you know, the but never in my life did I cut corners to, you know, I give somebody, you know, a piece that I gave them. I might add another 10 hours to the 40 hours. And they would pay that. But you can't double and triple your estimates on, you know, when you give it to people. So, you know, and that was me, and I held true to it. So I never went to college, but I paid a lot of money for my education. And, you know, it's called self-respect, and you know, it's a real good feeling. So now fast forwarding to the spring of 64 and moving to the farm and having my own bedroom. And, you know, I slept with two brothers in Westkill. And, you know, it was a crowded bed. So anyway, when we moved to New Kingston, there were seven kids and two parents, and we all had our own bedrooms. And it was awesome. Big Victorian house. And we... One summer we went out and we never cut we had 90 acre woodlot, and we never cut a tree that was a lumber tree to burn in our entire life. The beech had a bark disease, and the tops, you know, as soon as we seen a top crown die, we would, you know, and we would cut it down, and we burnt about a tree a day in our stove. We burnt 40 cord of wood a year to heat that house. And even at 40 cord a year, we were, and the only reason I know this, because one summer, when we were teenagers, we said, oh, you know, we're not going out in the winter and hauling in wood and blah, blah. And we took time and, you know, between haying and planting and all that shit, we went out and we were in the woods and we were hauling trees in, and we stacked up 40 acres of wood outside of our cellar. And by spring, it was gone. And that's 40 full acres of, you know, 40 full cords of wood. And I didn't realize then, you know, until then, how much wood we burnt in that house through the winter. But, you know, it was a lot. We burnt, average a tree a day. But my dad never cut a tree down that was any good for lumber. And what we did is the forest was pristine. And the new owners up there now that have owned it for about the last 20 years, the woodlot, it's a disaster. They don't go out and trim it. And you know, the stewards of our land, you know, when you come up and you buy these beautiful places and you know, you got to get your heart in it. I mean, just to own it, blah, blah, wah, wah, whatever. Well, I paid all this for that, and, you know, blah, blah. But, you know, it's overgrown, and when I was growing up on the farm, this is just for instance, we never had ticks. And what we have now is all these abandoned farms that are turning into forests, which is actually not a bad thing. But it's the in-between thing that's killing us, because we have made a tick incubator. They love moist, tall grass, and, you know, they don't like sun. They don't like being dry. And when we had, you know, 160 head of cows on the farm running the property, and, you know, 20, 25 horses running around. And, I mean, they kept things trimmed up. It was like a 250 acres of manicured property. And now, you know, I have 25, you know, over the years I've been able to buy 5 acres at a time. And I have a 25-acre lot up there now that I just... I'm building a garage and a house, and I'll be up, move back to where I was raised in about 2 years. And it's finally happening. But over the past 15 years, I've been buying little 5-acre parcels and this and that, and the old property I was raised on. About 20 years ago, my first parcel was a five-acre parcel. My sons and I, because, you know, I'm running the mill and I have the fruit for furnishings, and I never dried a piece of wood in my life, so I bought a dry kiln, 225,000 board foot, hooked it up, and started drying wood. And that was for the Dimension Mill, which I started in 1989. And that was from that point where Lynn Johnson told me, well, when you're gone, the business is gone. So Majestic Woodworking and Fleischmann's, actually it was Log Cutters, and they closed down and went to Majestic. And about 50 years ago, was it that long? About 45, 50 years ago, I worked at Alta with this guy named Chuck Proper. And he was the manager up to Log Cutters. And then when Majestic bought him out, they built, all they did was ash and pine furniture. And Chuck called me one day and he goes, you know, I got these, because Log Cutters used to do dimensional cutting before that. What that is a company calls you up, they order a certain thickness, by width, by length, kiln-dried, green, air-dried, whatever. And you know, most orders were minimum of 1,000 pieces. Most of them were 6,000 to 7,000. But anyway, they stopped doing that. So Chuck called me one day. He goes, oh, you want to go into the dimension business? I have these people that keep calling me. He said, all you need is a good rip saw and a planer. So I went out and I purchased those. I was renting space from Lynn Johnson, and that's when the Dimension Mill started. And, you know, Lynn Johnson put the auto museum in there, and I got booted out of that space, and I went down and I rented from Dick Fairburn for about 8 years, which is a mile from where my mill is. And so Dick Fairburn comes to me one day, and I think back then I had about 6 or 7 employees, and he said, well, you know, this land, the gravel underneath your building is worth more than I'm getting paid for the rent. He said, so you got 3 months to move out. So I'm devastated, and I'm driving up and down, and I went to the crossroads and those five-acre parcels over there that Timberland Properties had for sale, where the I guess they got the fitness center and that god-awful DEC building, whatever the hell that turned out to be. But anyway, I tried to buy a five-acre parcel, and because the business was going on it, they, like, quadrupled the prices. So I backed out of that, and I was leaving the mill one spring. It was in the spring of the year, and I was thinking from Vic Fairburn's, and Orville Rosa was out working in his garden. And, you know, when you're driving along and this light bulb goes off in your head and all of a sudden you just leer off the road. Well, I pulled in his driveway, I went out, and I said, geez, Orville, do you have any property for sale? And I don't know if you know where the sewer plant is in Margaville. And Orville Rosa has that big red barn on top of the hill where he excavated gravel out of there for the better part of 40 years. And, you know, he excavated, I think he at one point he had 6 or 8 trucks running and employees and you know, right away. And they took a huge amount. But anyway, he walked to the point off the garden. He said, he just put his arm out and he goes, I got about 10.5 acres over there, I'll sell you. And I go, oh, my God, really? He said, well, I'll talk to my wife, Kate, tonight, and I'll give you a shout in the morning, and we'll figure this out. So the next day I stopped, and he said, yeah, we're agreeable to it. There was no road. It was just a vacant piece of land. And, you know, Howard Fairburn, him and I got along like 2 peas in a pod, and he financed the whole thing for me to move 1 mile exactly down the road from where I was renting. And he, you know, he gave me a mortgage and, you know, fronted me the money, and I put the road in. And I can remember I needed a road down in there, and Dick Fairman says to me, because the mountain above the mill on South Side, it's rock ledges from the road all the way to the top of the mountain. And I've walked up that mountain many, many times. And you go to the top of it, and there's a rock ledge on top, and you walk out to it, and it looks like you could run and jump and land on Orville's house. That's how, you know, straight up it seems to go. I would never attempt it, but anyway, I mean, that's just how it looked. So anyway, Dick Fairbairn come back to me with this comment. He goes, oh, you know, rock ledges, blah, blah, and, you know. So I'm thinking, you know, I don't like working. I won't deal with people that are negative. So I jumped ship, and I went to Hubbell's because Rudd Hubbell was just starting his company. And he was over in the Beaverkill cutting for, actually building roads for Rockefeller. And I hunted over there for several years with Rob Allison. He's a local land surveyor. And I think we hunted over there for 10 or 15 years, opening day every day. We'd go over there, and I saw the work that Rudd had done over there. And he put, you know, ski trails and walking trails all through those mountains and the Beaverkill for Rockefeller. So I went to Rudd, and he said, oh, hell, we built roads up over rock ledges. I'm not afraid of a rock ledge. So I hired Hubbell's to put my road in. And they were there for about a week, and, you know, we had this bony stuff on top of the property, on the bottom of the property that Orville didn't excavate because it had, you know, boulders in it, you know, 2 foot and 3 foot in diameter. It just, they called it a bony, but it was this big, and they used that for the base. So the spirits smiled on me again. My whole life has been spirits guiding me and taking care of me, which is pretty awesome. So anyway, Tommy Briggs shows up one day, and he goes, oh, you know, that's when the mountainside was going in, and I was just moving on my property. And Tommy Briggs Construction come in, and Tommy come down, and he goes, oh, we need some sand, and we got this big, you know, 20,000-gallon fiberglass tank we want to bury, and we'll put, you know, he said, you know, I know you have sand on the bottom of the property, and he brought a big machine over, and he dug, and he said, oh, this is perfect, and he said, we'll trade you 300 loads of gravel for 30 loads of sand, and I said, deal. So that's why my road at the mill, when you come to the, well, it's a gallery now, when you come to the mill gallery, and I still do custom sawing and drying and all that stuff and my art. And, you know, right now I'm working for a guy that owns Miller's Drugstore. He's buying a lot of wood from me right now and are processing it. But, you know, that road on top is wide, and it's a beautiful road. I mean, it's one of the nicest roads in the Catskill because we put the bony stuff on the bottom. I got 320-yard dump truck loads of fine gravel from where they cleared the mountain off by Mountainside. And, you know, my road costed me $14,000. If I went to put that in today, it would be $140,000 at least. So anyway, so now I have this wonderful road and this wonderful place, and, but I did dimensional work for many, many years, and I had at one point 14 employees. And, you know, back when I first started, I had what I call the old school guys, and they were completely over the top awesome. I miss my old school guys. And 3 years before I had to close the mill, and had is the major word here, 3 years before I did close it, I told my current employees, because most of the guys I had working for me were older than me or my age, and they kind of went on, retired, and left. And so I had this, you know, 25, 35-year-old workforce now, and they had no clue. They just didn't have a clue. And the last 3 years of my company was the hardest years of my life because the last year I was in business, I actually had 3 full-time employees and 2 part-timers. And out of my 3 full-time employees, I got 5 40-hour weeks in 1 year and 1 hour of overtime. And a company cannot run like this, especially when I, you know, they're kind of mandatory 10 hours overtime. But what had happened to me is I was down there, they'd leave it. It's a long, I'm not going to go into the whole details of it, but they were completely useless, and they caused me more aggravation than I ever had in my life. So I found myself down there. I'd go down after supper at 7 o'clock at night, and I'd work till 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, because I'm a man of my word, and if I gave one of these companies that they were going to be shipped this load on Wednesday, they got shipped on Wednesday. And I'm down there at night from 7 to 1 in the morning at the rip saw and the planer, planing and ripping stuff by myself because I had these lame-ass people that couldn't come to work. And so, long story short, I sold my commercial accounts to a very wonderful company in Kingston, Excelsior Wood Products, and Ron Sawyer. We hopped in the truck. I had 3 standing accounts in 3 different states, Connecticut, New York, and Massachusetts. We drove to every single one of those companies, and I introduced Ron to them, and them to Ron, and this is a new guy that's taking over your stuff. Every single company told me the same thing. They said, you know, you didn't have to do this. And I said, well, yes, I did, because the fact that I don't want to do it anymore, or I actually didn't, not that I didn't want to, I 3 years before I closed my company down, I told my employees, in 3 years, if this company isn't running without me, because I just, you know, I've been doing this for 40 years, standing in the saw, running 10,000 pieces a day, and I don't want to do it anymore. And it's mindless work, really, but the fact that I enjoyed it. I love seeing all the different species. I bought low grade. I got to see hickory, ash, birch, beech, soft maple, hard maple, red oak, white oak. I mean, every time I run the board, I'm getting giddy inside, basically. And, you know, that's what makes a day go fast. But, you know, these other people, it was a job to them. And when your life becomes a job, you really need to fix that. So, anyway, these companies, they were very grateful. So it was a smooth transition from me closing down to, you know, my company and turning it over to a respectable company that... And I call them every couple of months, and, you know, these people are like family to me. And everybody's doing fine. So, you know, Ron was grateful to get to work, and this was just before pandemics had hit. And, you know, it worked out good for everybody. So, anyway, I'm an artist now, and it's not by choice. It's something that I don't call myself an artist. I'm a messenger. And what I do is I give messages of good feelings. Because while the mill was running, I never needed money because I'm not greedy. Shit, I made $14,000 last year, and I can live off that. And, you know, it makes no never mind to me. It's just money has taken over. When it takes over your mind and that's all you think and live, you really missed your whole life. Money is like a sander or a carving tool and something that's so awesome that you can just hold in your hand and make something with. Money for me is the same thing. If I didn't need money, I wouldn't need it. You know, if I didn't need a sander, I wouldn't buy one. But, you know, I need money as a tool. I need to pay my bills and whatnot, because if I don't, you know, you know, what'll happen then. But I don't let money, you can't let money put a ring in your nose and lead you around through life. If you're living, you know, I was taught in school, and it's a very bad thing to teach in school. Successful people are rich. Successful people are not rich. Successful people have a rich mind and soul, and their heart is full of joy, and that's richness. That's wealth. You know, wealth is not money. You know, people got to stop thinking that wealth is money. Money sucks, basically, and it separates people. And, you know, I was very fortunate to be raised. I never knew. I was 17 before I realized I left the farm, and I never experienced money before. And so I never had a harness on me. I never, you know, put a ring in my nose. And you know, you folks that are running around chasing money your whole life, I feel bad for you. But anyway, I want to read this piece. We haven't even played a song tonight. But, you know, when John told me about what we were talking about tonight, I said, how can I sum up 67 years in an hour? But I'm doing the best I can, folks. I hope nobody's outside the station here with stones. But anyway, I wrote this piece in 12-1 of 2011, 7 in the morning. I spent my whole before this time trying to run away from this thing that they call art, and I don't understand it, but it's I realized in 12-1-2001, actually maybe a couple of years before that, but I was able to write about it at this point in my life, and I wrote this at 7 in the morning when I was first getting up, and it's called The Addictive Curse Gift. The gift has always been there, I must say. A curse, really, that has been leading the way, not understanding its full meanings in yesterdays. Someone always around you trying to lead it astray. What did you know, so being so young at heart, you would be dealing with this life force called art? I do not expect you all to understand. I do not get it either, but it's my life's demand. You were pushing it away day after day after day. I did try and take another road to see what's there. The addiction so deep, the new road just disappears. Tried leaving it behind at times by running away, ending up back here in this pleasurable, miserable place. There are three perfect words to describe it, though. The gift is the pleasure in one finding oneself, then cursed by all the problems that it can create and the addictive behaviors that always find your fate. The choices you make daily during your life are driven by these three strong life forces, leaving behind sometimes many a days, finding only great comfort in painful details, and being told by many that it must be so great to have such a talent to love and create, them not seeing the trade-off every day, being pulled into a world with a one-track mind. It's really quite lonely most of the time. Mind and body so busy, loneliness goes on unnoticed, till suddenly something puts you back on the street, in the middle of a crowd. Just want to get away. Just leave me alone by myself and let me create. Expected other partners to help and understand. They would just put their forceful foot down with many demands. Tried real hard to pleasure them in every way. Then, addictive curse gift art shows up to take it away. I have to go along, for the choice is not mine. Being most grateful my art is so kind. I see many mean people doing many mean things, and it drives me deeper and deeper into my dreams. And after all my years here on earth, I have to say in my defense, it's the only place I can go to feel perfectly safe. And that's the God's honest truth, because when I'm working on my art, nothing in the world matters. It's an amazing gift and passion that I've been gifted with. And you know, most of my life I was, you know, trying to run away from it and make it go away. And when I started the Dimension Mill, I didn't think I'd be doing any more, you know, work and on furniture in the art world, but I couldn't stop. So basically, while the Dimension Mill was running, I worked on my house for the better part of 20 some years, and it's a work of art, my whole house. I mean, ceilings and cabinets and walls and pantries and you know, everything in my house, and I have all the mountain woods. And that's another thing I have to bring front and center to you folks is, I mean, when I first started woodworking, it was all mahogany and, you know, rosewood and coca-cola and all these teak and everything from the rainforest and overseas and you know, the best wood. I'm telling you folks, in these mountains here, we have the best wood in the entire world. I'm not discounting stuff from other parts of the world, but as far as variety and sustainability, we have the best wood in the world. And, you know, for instance, Black Locust, which the DEP, I'm telling you, sometimes they get such a brain fart they can't think, but they've realized they made a Black Locust an invasive species. That's just a sick kind of a statement to me, because Black Locust will last 100 years outdoors, and teak will last 30 to 40. We cut down the rainforest, and we should have been harvesting trees from our mountains and putting along the beaches and all along our shores, because it would outlast teak, and we would still have part of our rainforest left. When we're out of time, been a great show. Sorry we didn't have much music for you. But.
Gary, we didn't even talk about the new Kingston property. That was my original idea. So we'll have to have a part B, huh?
Well, we will, yeah. But, you know, I own 25 acres up there now. We did talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, we'll delve into it some more. But this was From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7. We talk about a different forest-related topic, and that's all we got for you tonight.
Well, happy Thanksgiving, Merry Christmas, and, you know, fill your love... Your heart's so full of love that there's no room for hate. That's all I got to say.
Good night, everyone.
Peace, everybody.
She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games. In an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river runs down from the forest. With a mighty roar, the big jet soars above the canyon streets. And the con man con, but life goes on, for the city never sleeps.